Well, hey there, everybody. This is another bonus episode, kind of one of my episodes where I just catch up with a previous guest and talk about something they've been doing lately or a cool project that they've finished or embarked upon. And so this time I'm catching up with JW Ortic. Hey, JW.
Hello. How's it going?
Good, good. It's good to have you on. I think the last time I had you on was for the Lady Hawk panel.
That sounds correct, which was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that was fun. Yeah. But something that you've been working through for a while is reading all the Hugos, but not just all the Hugos, all the Hugo nominees as well. And you finished that, I don't know, a couple months ago?
Actually, it might have been late last year. I don't remember exactly what day it was, but okay. Yes, every single nominee.
Yeah. And then so on your blog, which we'll make sure people have a link to, you've been doing kind of my read through of the Hugos, right? And you'll do a year and talk about give letter grades to each of the nominees.
Yeah. So I kind of just decided to do that because, you know, there's always the question as a fan of did they get it right?
Right.
You know, or you, obviously everyone has their own opinions. So I just wanted to give a score and hopefully kind of direct other people who have similar interests to find some of those diamonds in the rough, especially some of the older Hugo nominees that might not be read, you know, people might not know as much about anymore.
Yeah. It's interesting too, when you go back, if you go back far enough, you can find the winner, but you can't find anything about the nominees. And that's a little frustrating sometimes.
Yes.
And now you're working your way through the Nebulas as well. Have you finished the Nebulas?
I've read all of the Nebula winners now.
Okay.
As far as the nominees, I haven't really done a count. I think there's a lot of overlap between the two. So I think I'm in the like 40 to 60% range on those.
Okay.
I had kind of started that during the Hugo process too, just as a break, I guess, once in a while.
Yeah, I had noticed at some point when I finished the list of Hugos and I switched over to the Nebula list just to see where am I on this. And it's essentially 50%. I had read a couple of the others that weren't Hugo winners, but it's a pretty good jump on that list. And that was one reason I was like, I don't want to just jump over to another list and have to work my way through, you know, 30 or 40 titles.
Right.
So that's why I extended it to all the other lists. Though I would like to finish the Nebula winners just because there's a Discord that we're both on for readers of the Nebulas and the Hugos, and you get special gloss if you finish either or both of the lists. So
it was a proud moment in my life when I, you know, got the what are they calling it now, the Space Magus or
yes,
something like that to have finished them all. You know, I want to try to get to like the British Science Fiction Award, and I mean, there's a bunch of them, obviously Arthur C. Clarke or Aurora. Some of the ones that kind of branch out more from the very American-centric, you know, Hugo.
Sure. Yeah. So I guess one of the questions that always comes up is how do you do this? You know, how do you get through so many books? And how many books did you read last year?
I think I hit right at 700 last year.
and when I tell people that, they just go, well, he's lying.
Yeah, that's I get that too. People at work though, can attest to this. I mean, when I go on my break and my lunch at work, there's always a book in hand, you know, sometimes even as I'm walking to my locker to put the book away. but yeah, I do get asked that question a lot. How do you read so much? And I was talking about this with my wife, actually, like, how do I even answer this? Cause I guess my first answer is always kind of like, I don't know. I just read. It's just what I like to do. And she's like, that kind of is the answer, you know, like other people have hobbies. Like I have friends who like Warhammer and they paint the minis and they spend, you know, 7 hours on their weekend. And it's like, I don't do that. I do all that time is spent reading books. And reading books is the kind of thing that you can do alongside other hobbies or other tasks. You know, like when I like to ride my bike or run. So I listen to audiobooks while I'm doing that. When I'm doing the dishes on my day off, you know, when I'm doing cleaning, I'm listening to audiobooks. So it's like, you don't even necessarily have to stop what you're doing to read or listen to books. You can do other things. And I know this sounds, I think my neighbors probably think I'm crazy, because one thing I like to try to do every day is at least get to the 10,000 steps, you know, that sort of myth of staying healthy with 10,000 steps. But, and I'll literally walk in my living room in circles with a book in my hand while I'm like reading the book and turning the pages.
So, yeah.
I guess there's a lot of answers, but really it kind of just comes down to that's what brings joy to my life is reading books and experiencing these stories. And so I spend a lot of time doing it.
Yeah. And I mean, I used to, I remember when the Harry Potter books were still coming out, right? The last couple of them, you know, or I'd pre-order it. And as soon as it would get there, I'd like, I don't want to work today. I want to read the book, you know? And, I know that the Harry Potter books have fallen out of favor for some good reasons, but it didn't change the fact that they were enjoyable reads at the time. And I remember I work at a big campus and of five buildings and a conference center. And so if you walk around the outside of it, it's about a mile. And so I'd walk around with this big hardcover on the sidewalks and just every now and then glance up, make sure I'm not going to run into anything. But you know, you can get it so where your field of view is good enough to see if you're going to walk into a tree or a person. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad I'm not the only one, because people always tell me I'm crazy when I do that. Cause like I've done walks around my block, like with the book in hand and things like that. And I'm like, I'm sure people think I look really weird, but it's just something I enjoy doing. Other people, you know, walk their dogs and I walk my book. So.
Yeah. You don't have to pick up after your book. So,
yeah.
And you know, I definitely do similar things where like I'm out gardening, you know, pulling weeds or something. And I've got an audiobook going, right. And walking the dog, it's usually audiobooks as well. And this is one of your other secrets of how you get through books so fast is you're a fast audiobook listener.
Yeah, it was actually because of the Hugo Quest that I started to kind of ratchet up the speed for a long time, you know, just at one time speed on all audiobooks. And then it was actually, I remember the book it was that started to push me towards it, which was A Time of Changes by Robert Silverberg. And there was an audiobook at the library system. So I picked it up and I was listening. I was like, you know, this reader, I really enjoyed the reader. Actually, it's one of my favorite narrated books of all time. But it was just kind of slow. And so I just titched it up a notch. I want to say to 1.2 or something like that. And it sounded so much better. And it was actually much more listenable, if I'll just use that as a word. And since then, I kind of just kept maybe every 6 months or so, I just ratcheted up just a slight bit more. And I just recently moved it up to, and now granted, some readers are faster. So I tone it back down if they're speaking really quickly, because it just gets to be sort of chipmunky. But I'm usually hitting like that 2.85 or so speed now. So I mean, like a 21 hour book is going to take you, you know, 7:40 or something like that. You know, I wouldn't recommend it as much for like nonfiction, but for fiction, it's pretty easy to follow conversations because we don't talk at the speed people narrate books, right? Like you listen to audiobooks. To me, sometimes some of them at one time speed are painfully slow.
Agreed.
And so ratcheting it up just makes sense to me to make it sort of more pleasant anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So when I found this out, I have generally stuck at 1.5, 1.6. For podcasts, it's 1.5 all the time, unless it's like Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. And then it's like two and a half, three times, because he's so slow. And the episodes are 4 hours long sometimes. I started creeping it up and just like, well, what's it like at 1.75? And you're right. It does depend on the narrator, where there's sometimes where I'm like, okay, I'm not getting this. Or, you know, this is the problem with audiobooks. If your mind wanders a little bit, you know, you can miss quite a bit, and it's harder to page backwards. I know you can jump back 30 seconds, but it's not the same as like turning a page backwards in a book.
No, it is harder to re-pick up that trail if you get lost on it.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I've kind of stuck at 2x speed, and I'm finding that it works quite well for almost every book. So I don't know that I'll push on. We'll see. Once things lock in and I'm acclimated to it, we'll see. Because yeah, there's times where like on my podcast player, the plugin in the player that allows the modified speed crashes. And it dumps me back to 1.0 speed, and everybody sounds so weird.
Right.
because it's like your brain has gotten used to taking up the information at that speed. And so you're like, this isn't how people really sound, is it? I feel like the Flash, you know, like everything's going by like molasses. So,
yeah, I think it was at Worldcon in Chicago where I talked to some people that I'd only listened to on podcasts before, which again, it was like 1.5 or 2.5 times speed I'd heard them. And I was like, oh, this is like their actual voice. Mm-hmm. This is what they sound like in real life.
The crazy thing for me is when people have music and I only ever hear it at 1.5 speed. And then I hear it normally. I'm like, that's jarring.
Oh yeah.
It sounds completely like different.
Music or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you do get, and you've seen this, right, where people are like, well, I like to savor books, you know, so, and I understand there are people who are not going to like faster speeds in audio. I want to take it in the way that the creator, you know, intended it. But I just feel like, you know, let people do things the way they do and don't tell them that they're not getting the same experience of the book as you, which, to be fair, you're not. Nobody ever reads the same book. So, right. Yeah.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. You know, one thing that I think I've had people just talking about people at work or other people interested in reading, you know, being like, wow, you read so much. I feel guilty. It's like, why would you feel guilty? Like, read at the pace you want to read, read at what you want to read. And there are books that I do way slow down and savor. I mean, one way I read a lot of books is by reading lots of books at the same time. I literally have a stack of like 20 books sometimes where I'm reading a chapter a day out of each one, mm-hmm. alongside library books and things that I'm reading that sort of more project type things.
Yeah. I call that shift reading.
Yeah. Yeah. And some of those, you know, like right now I'm rereading The Will of the Many, I always want to say Jason, but I think it's James Islington, came out last year, and I loved it. And I wanted to really sit down and savor it more. So I've been reading like literally just one chapter a day and mm-hmm. just very slowly these like 10 to 15 page chapters. So, you know, the experience may vary, and it will vary, like you said, even from time to time rereading the same book, you're going to have a different experience of that book.
Yeah. Yeah. I pick my spots where I really want to savor something. And, you know, I still read, it's a pretty good, I think I've increased my audio uptake, just because it's convenient. And so like when the Hugo nominees came out, you know, I immediately went to Libby and put hold requests on all the audiobooks for everything that I could find. Right. Actually, I did it when the Nebulas came out, figuring that there would be some overlap. And there were only a couple, that helps me kind of get through being able to keep up a little bit with at least like the voting for this year.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, why did you set out to read the Hugos? Where did that come from?
So I know this sounds crazy because the internet obviously existed, but I didn't think about looking more. I, for a long time as a reader, even through like college, the only science fiction I'd really read was like Star Wars books.
Oh, similar with me.
What was that?
Similar story for me. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I just knew that I enjoyed the idea of science fiction. I just didn't really know where to go for it. I'd also read Ender's Game in high school and was a fan of that. And I'd read Dune in college because it was one that I just heard lots of people talking about, and I quite mm-hmm. enjoyed that. But I was like, well, where do I go from here? And I, you know, in my younger years, I'd read some Ben Boba and stuff. So just a smattering, but mostly Star Wars. And so I kind of just like Googled at one point, like, you know, list of best science fiction novels. And there was this one, it still exists. I think it's called Sci-Fi Lists. It's like an sffjazz.something.com or something like that.
If you find it, send it to me.
Yeah, yeah. He has these, you can tell the website was made in the 90s. It's definitely like a bare bones, just text and links. Mm. But it's basically like people would go, and I think the only way he ranks them is just by having people, you know, vote on them, and then it just ranks them in the top 100 or top 200. And he's recently split it so it's by like decades or something like that. But back then, when I first got to the site, I just read the first 200 books on the list, and it took me, I don't know, 3 or 4 years to track them all down through interlibrary loan and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But that really sort of broadened my taste. And one thing I kept seeing, and that I remembered seeing on Ender's Game, was this Hugo Award stamp on so many books, like winner of the Hugo Award, you know, mm-hmm. this author won the Hugo Award. And I was like, what even is this? And
right.
So I got a book from the library, Joe Walton,
Informal History.
Yeah, of the Hugos, and which is a great book, especially I think for fans of the genre. Like, you're going to get a ton of information and knowledge, not just about the Hugo Awards, but also, she just has a huge knowledge of the field in so many ways, and mm-hmm. and it's very fun to just hear her voice speaking to you through the book. But she didn't read all of the nominees, and I was like, what the heck? Why wouldn't you read all the nominees when you're talking about them all? And yeah. I mean, she has some really good reasons for doing so. But I was like, I could do that. I could read every nominee. And so I just did. I just kind of sat down, and, you know, I went to the library system, and I started to like write down all the ones that they had in a spreadsheet, and the ones they didn't have, I started to just get them through interlibrary loan. And I think I started trying to read all the Hugo nominees in like 2014, 2015, somewhere around there. And only just finished, like I said, either late last year or early this year. So, I mean, it took some time to get through them all. I finally counted them this morning. Actually, there's 361.
Okay, I was going to ask you that.
Ones. Unless I miscounted, so someone can come along and correct me. And those are, again, are the ones that are known. We do have, like you said, I want to say it's 1955 or something like that, where like the nominee list is very partial.
Yeah.
I think we know of like one other nominee, which I have read, but when you look on Wikipedia, there aren't any other nominees but the winner that year. And
yeah.
So some of those might be lost to time, but of the ones that are known and confirmed, I've read all of them.
Okay. Nice. It's yeah. I mean, talking about the stamps on the books, right? Hugo winning book, right? People always, you know, especially after last year with the stuff that happened in Chengdu, right? People want to bury the Hugos and say, oh, these aren't relevant anymore. But for authors, I mean, it's a real marketing tool. You know, if you win the Hugo, that has effect on sales.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the average reader, like if you walk into a bookstore and you don't know the context and you just see winner of whatever award, that just is going to potentially clue you in. You know, then there are people who have the opposite reaction where they're like, I don't want an award winner. That's popular or whatever. And that's fine too. But I think there is still a great value to the Hugos. And I think, you know, obviously there was plenty of controversy about last year's, but I still think the community that exists around the Hugos and other awards is extremely valuable and honestly super inclusive and fun to be part of. And definitely helpful to the authors. Like, you know, obviously, again, you can talk about last year. We could do multiple podcasts about last year, but when it comes down to it, I still think most authors would say it's valuable to have them exist and to have them just awards in general to have that spotlight. And if I could go on a quick aside, I'm a judge in the self-published science fiction contest, SPSFC. So we call it Space Fic for short. And we've only done 3 years. But let me tell you, the amount of readers that have popped up on some of these indie authors some of the books we've had submitted where they have literally zero reviews on Amazon or one review on Goodreads or something like that. Mm-hmm. And some of these books that are actually quite excellent and entertaining. And so being able to shine the spotlight on these authors is just a phenomenal opportunity, not just for readers, but also for them. And I think the Hugos is just sort of that, you know, on the much bigger scale.
Yeah. 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 That reminds me, I was talking to my brother-in-law yesterday, and somebody that we used to work with just published a book he'd been working on for like 10 years. And I was like, oh, I should tell JW about it because it was self-published.
Send it to me.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, has it been worth it, right? Reading all the Hugo winners, was there anything that broke you that was like, oh, I don't know if this is worth it. and you know, I my podcast, right? I don't tend to dwell on the negative. And so if you don't want to badmouth any books or say, oh, this was a terrible winner, that's fine. If you know, a more positive way to say that is, I would have preferred this winner this year, but, you know, if you want to bag on something, feel free.
So, I mean, the first thing that came to mind when you asked the question that way is actually funny to me because Robert Silverberg, I read Dying Inside from that original list of like top 200 books and I hated it. I absolutely detested that book. Mm. And so on the Hugos, he was nominated, I want to say 11 times or something like that. And he never won for best novel. And I was like, man, I don't know if I want to read any more of this guy's books after I hated that one. But it honestly ended up being the exact opposite, where I found a deep love and appreciation of Silverberg's novels. And I do think some of them are still stinkers, but that's going to be true for anyone's writing. And in fact, I have now read Dying Inside 3 times and I finally got it on the 3rd time. My dad passed in 2020 and that gave some context to Dying Inside because I never realized how much about loss it was before. Mm. And it's just a really beautiful look at a sort of crappy human dealing with a sense of like impending loss and struggling through that in a very real way. And so I think, did you tack on the question of which ones I think should have won?
I definitely do want to get to that at some point.
Sure. But yeah, as far as being broken, I think I could definitely list like some books where I was just like, oh gosh, why am I doing this? Or I am a huge victim of the sunk cost fallacy. Once I start a book, I pretty much will finish, even if I hate everything about it. Because I've already started, I may as well continue.
Right. Yeah.
And so there was basically no point where I was about to give up this quest for the Hugo nominees. They, you know, it could have all been horrible and I would have done it one way or another. But I'm honestly super glad I did because, like I said, Silverberg's just one example of reading an author that I never, ever would have touched before. Like there wouldn't have been any, you know, people that I wouldn't have known existed without trying to go through a list like this.
Okay. So I often get the question when I did my kind of ask me anything, people asked variations of, you know, have you learned anything through this process about the way the Hugo Awards have changed or the way the genre has changed? And I'm curious if you've had any epiphanies about that.
Yeah, I was thinking about this after I finished the quest, actually, and you know, obviously some during it. And I'm by no means an expert in the history of science fiction. There are experts in the history of science fiction, and so I would kind of leave that to them.
Yeah.
I would say for one thing, though, I really wish that we had more history of science fiction books out there. There aren't that many. Mm. And it's truly fascinating because science fiction, in my opinion at least, at its best, isn't about some imagined future or trying to predict some future. Really, it's about the human condition and about what we're dealing with now and how we might be able to deal with it, either in the future or in an imagined alternate now. And so for me, as far as things that I learned, I learned a lot of names of authors that I didn't know before. Mm. But, you know, New Wave science fiction was something I didn't know existed. And obviously, it sort of took over the Hugo Awards for a decade, and seeing this sort of transition between from this sort of like pulp era science fiction, where it was largely a lot of sort of rocket ships and lasers, and there were things outside of that too, but that was sort of the majority, and into this being aware of the literary conventions and being aware of social sciences and being aware of psychology and integrating those things into science fiction in new imaginative and sometimes pretty rough ways. So watching some of these decades waves of how science fiction reflected the sort of feeling of the time in which it was published was really enlightening. And I've talked before about the 90s too. The 90s, if you look at the Hugo nominees for the 90s, it's dominated by hard science fiction. You know, well, what was happening
right,
during the 90s?
Mars books,
you know,
yeah.
Like, you know, we had the resurgence of interest in NASA. I mean, I remember as a kid, all of this NASA stuff and explore space and, you know, like all these movements going with that and suddenly hard science fiction. It just, I mean, there are years where like 4 out of 5 nominees could be easily classified as hard sci-fi. Hmm. So that would be, I guess, something I would say I learned too, is just seeing how sort of the general tenor of the time impacted the awards. I think it's pretty clear sometimes.
So I kind of have two related questions, right? Like, are there any years where you feel like, oh, the voters got this one obviously wrong? And kind of tied together with, are there any favorite reads of yours among the non-winners? And so, you know, there's the, I really enjoyed that, but I don't think it should have won kind of thing, right? You can definitely have a favorite read among the non-winners and not think that it necessarily should have won. But, you know, there's some nuance there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there are two ways to approach that too, because, you know, when you say what could have or should have won that didn't, if you include things that weren't nominated, I mean, looking back, it's much easier. Like hindsight is 2020, right? Like
yeah.
Fellowship of the Ring, right? Fellowship of the Ring wasn't even nominated for the 1955 ballot, which is famously allegedly the worst Hugo winner of all time. They'd Rather Be Right, which I know you've talked about, and mm-hmm. neither one of us thinks it's actually that bad. I kind of just feel sort of milquetoast about it. It's fine.
Yeah.
But the Fellowship of the Ring, like, you know, not even there is a chance. And so looking at hindsight, it's easy to just point to that and be like, no way. But I think that there's other egregious misses as far as the ballot. Like Octavia Butler never was nominated for Best Novel. And I think that anyone would be remiss to not list her as maybe the top 5 science fiction novelists of, you know, that century. So just seeing her not get a nomination, I think is a huge miss, especially because some of the years, I want to say it was like Parable of the Sower, Parable of the Talents, where I was like, this easily would have won as far as on its own merits. But as you said, you know, taste is its own thing. Some people will like books, some people won't, and that's okay. As far as years where I think that it was wrong, if I had to choose a single year, I would say 1973. That year, The Gods Themselves won, which is by Asimov, obviously super popular author, one of the names that instantly comes to mind when you think about science fiction, but not one of his best novels, in my opinion. Very readable, fairly enjoyable overall novel, but it was up against not one, but two Silverberg books, which I actually thought are significantly better. Book of Skulls, it would be sort of like the Dark Horse candidate. It's also has some very, it's just a very dark themed story of a road trip across the United States to try to discover immortality with a group of monks that has published this Book of Skulls, basically saying that they have the secret to immortality. And it goes south literally and figuratively very quickly. And it's just so viscerally powerful as a read. I can still sort of imagine scenes and feel them in my head when I think about them in both good and sometimes even disgusting ways. That year also had Dying Inside on the ballot. Now, I don't know how many, in fact, I think 73 was the only year that an author had two books officially on the ballot. I believe that it's happened before where they withdrew one of them, and so it doesn't show up anymore. Mm. But Silverberg actually had both of these books on the ballot, and they didn't have the ranked choice voting back then, as far as I know. So Dying Inside, to me, was the clear and obvious winner, and as I've already talked about, just a tremendous novel about just human nature and loss and suffering in a way that I think very few novels in general, not just science fiction, have grasped that feel for me. So
that's interesting, though, because you said you kind of bounced off that one the first time.
I did.
And so I wonder if that explains why it didn't win.
Yeah, I mean, if I had a guess, and again, I'm not a historian of the Hugos or by any stretch, my guess would be that Silverberg probably would have won that year, but having two novels on it just split the votes for him in a way that just didn't help him. And I just think it's really unfortunate, because there are other years where he had books on the ballot where I was like, that easily could have won because they were really good. He has some really excellent stories. A Time of Change is one I mentioned earlier with the audiobooks, and I love that book. So I guess to segue into that from to the second question you had, which is the favorite reads among non-winners. There are so many. I kind of thinking about it, it's like, you know, do I pick a top 20? But narrowing it down, Brittle Innings by Michael Bishop, that would be definitely a top five for me. I know that I believe you enjoyed that one quite a bit.
I haven't read it yet. Don't spoil it too much. I read like the first chapter, and then I stopped just because I have a guest in mind for it and I don't want to jinx it.
Perfect.
Not that I believe in jinxes.
Spoil anything of the ending or anything, but it, essentially on its face, it's just a novel about baseball. And I want to say it's in Oklahoma in the 1940s. And so issues of race, issues of gender that you would imagine would come up in such a time and place, they do. Having played a lot of baseball in my life and loving baseball like I do, Michael Bishop absolutely captures the feel of being on a baseball diamond. And in ways that even novels that are just about baseball haven't done. Like there were times where I felt like I could literally breathe in the dust from that baseball diamond. It was so vivid. And it is also a science fiction novel, and very much so at some point. So I really hope you enjoy it. It's such a treat. And to me, one of the best Hugo nominations just in general. I love that book.
Nice. I mean, you know that I'm a huge baseball fan as well. And so yes. I like in the spring and summer to read a baseball book. And so Brittle Innings was probably going to be the one that I do this year.
Brittle Innings will be an excellent choice for you. So another one that comes to mind, it actually has multiple titles, but The Planet Buyer by Cord Wainer Smith. It's more familiarly known as Norstrelia, which is like Australia, but North combined. Cord Wainer Smith is a pseudonym, and I forget what the guy's original name was, but the actual person, he was like an expert in psychological warfare. He had multiple, you know, languages under his belt, and all of these things sort of get integrated into his science fiction stories. He has a bunch of science fiction short stories and this one novel that are all in the same general universe over the course of, like, I want to say over 1,000 years. And they're so zany. I mean, we're talking like they use sheep and psychological warfare together in ways that it just doesn't seem like it should ever work, especially not in a novel form. And it absolutely does. So that would be one. I think anyone who's a big fan of science fiction, especially looking for vintage sci-fi, should check out Cord Wainwright-Smith. It's unlike anything I've read anywhere else. I mean, there is no equivalent to him, in my opinion.
And that one was going up against The Wanderer.
Yeah, and The Wanderer was not terrible. A very good yeah. book.
Yeah, yeah.
At least in my opinion. I'm sure fans of it exist out there, but I've yet to run into any, despite, you know, asking many people who have read yeah. it. And then I guess I'll just go with one more. I have, like I said, I could probably start listing dozens, but another one, maybe lesser known, would be When Gravity Fails by George Alec Effinger. I might be pronouncing that name incorrectly. It's, you know, one of the big foibles of being a reader is that you rarely hear some of these words out loud, especially right. names.
That's the benefit of audiobooks.
Yes, yes. So apologies if I got that wrong. But When Gravity Fails, to me, I want to say it was 1988 on the ballot. And it is cyberpunk, which is not a favorite subgenre of mine, to be honest. But it has a sort of futuristic mystery going on. It has this sort of issues of gender aren't front and center. They're just there in ways that feel extremely ahead of its time. Like not directly trans people, but the option of being trans essentially just exists in this world and is just a given. And the mystery at the heart of the story is absolutely fascinating and well done. And the voice of the main character is just so well written. I adore it. And one of my favorite subgenres is just mashing up mystery with any sort of science fiction. I just love having that sort of, like, you know, what would they do in this spaceship if a murder happened? You know, it gives that extra dimension that we can't necessarily get if it was just a mystery novel or if it was just a science fiction novel. And Effinger, if I'm pronouncing the name right, just nails that feel and creates a world where it just, I mean, I would love to just live there. Well, I wouldn't because it's pretty brutal, but I would love to see it sometime.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Awesome. I think we can get a couple more.
Okay. All right. Well, great. in that case, a favorite of mine ever since I was a child is Squares of the City. That one's by John Bruner. Again, apologies, yeah. John. Squares of the City is it's not really very spoilery because it's in the novel. At the end, I think he points this out. But the bare bones of the plot of Squares of the City is that you have an American. I think he's an American. Ooh, it's been a while now. But he goes to a made-up South American country, and his job is basically just as a city planner. And he's supposed to basically just help figure out some of, like, the traffic issues in this city. And this fictional South American country is sort of dominated by, like, a despotic dictator. And the plot, though, is actually based upon a rather famous, I guess, chess game. And so characters end up being pawns or queens or bishops and being taken off the board in interesting ways. Now, not literally taking off the board. There's not, like, an actual chessboard involved, but it's called the Squares of the City. And when you think about the plot that way, it's actually quite amazing to see how he managed to integrate essentially a science fiction's narrative over a chess game in a way that just really actually works quite well and is an extremely robust commentary on colonialism and race and in ways, again, which seem very ahead of its time. I believe that one was from the 1960s. I want to say 66. I love the book. I love the cover. It grabbed me. I saw it at a used bookstore when I was maybe like 12 years old, and I grabbed it and I read it. I did not understand it at all. And, you know, I've read it probably 3 or 4 times since, and I adore that novel.
That's one I had never heard of.
Yeah, it's very good. And obviously Brunner, apologies to the man. He, you know, is well known for Stand on Zanzibar, The Sheep Look Up, you know, so he has quite a few novels under his belt, but that one, I just almost never see it mentioned. And I think like it should be mentioned. It's very good. Another one that I would choose would be Calculating God by Robert J. Sawyer. Robert J. Sawyer is sort of hit or miss for me, but he has, no matter what, he's going to give you some pretty good hard science fiction combined with usually some sort of like thriller-esque plot. Mm-hmm. Calculating God, the premise is basically that aliens show up on Earth. It's just say modern day. I want to say it was written in the early 2000s. So early 2000s Earth, aliens show up in Canada, and instead of saying take me to their leader, your leader, they say take me to your paleontologist. And it turns out that these aliens believe in God. They just take it for granted that God exists. And they're sort of surprised that the paleontologist, who's the main character of the story, doesn't believe in God. And the reason being basically that they have found that when they look at paleontology, they can find that like they and several other alien species, including now humans, had these sort of like similar intentional disastrous events in their evolutionary past, which seem to have tried to set up for intelligent life. And so, so the premise includes that, but then it includes like, well, is there another doomsday event coming? Is there actually a God? What is this God? If there is such a God, is it just some being out there? And it explores it in ways which I think science fiction often asks questions about God and our ultimate existence, but, doesn't always give you answers. And Robert J. Sawyer is like, surprisingly in this book, totally unafraid to just provide a really weird and sort of zany answer that I just really love it. And it's another one where I just think like more people should read this book. It's really, it's fun and inventive, and it asks big questions in ways that, you know, not a lot of science fiction, like I said, provides answers, and he right. tries. So
unlike the Fountains of Paradise, where Arthur C. Clarke has an alien probe come through and say, "Hey, by the way, God's not real," you know.
right. Yeah, and you know, and we could go off on a huge tangent about that. You know, science fiction and religion and how they interact. But and Sawyer, as far as I know, is not necessarily a friend of religion in general. He's asking some of the big questions and like.
Yeah.
You know, introducing ways to think about them that, you know, might make basically anyone upset, but at least makes you think. And
yeah.
A good science fiction, I think, should make you care or concerned about, again, the human condition and why are we here? What are we doing? What can we improve? What could we, you know, do better? So.
Nice. Talking of Robert J. Sawyer, I want to give a shout out here to Colin and Phil from the Science Fiction 101 podcast, who recently interviewed Robert J. Sawyer about his book, The Downloaded, that dropped as an Audible original before it's come out in print. And so they have an interview with him about that and then about other things. They haven't put out the second half of it yet, but you know, it'll come out soon.
Nice. And I mean, I've been honestly a fan of his works. There are other books I could put on this list from him. He did actually win for, I want to say, Hominids.
Yeah.
And that whole trilogy has been one that I've read and reread from various different lights, you know, going from, you know, someone who didn't really understand science to someone who gets science a lot more has made just a lot of his works much more enjoyable. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But yeah, the Neanderthal Parallax. I believe is what that trilogy
yeah.
is.
Yeah. Called. I think I've read the first two. I've been saving the third one. So,
yeah. And those are books that I do when I reread them now, I just savor, you know, I do read them slowly because it's like, I know what's happening, but I like to imagine that Neanderthal world where honestly, everything feels kind of just better in so many
right,
ways.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a trope, right? Where he's using this probably over idealized, you know, perfectly hunter-gatherer balanced, you know, making sure to not reproduce too much, just to keep under the carrying capacity of the land and that kind of stuff. And he's using that to look back at us and go, see, yeah, we could have done that and we didn't.
Right. We could do a little better. And I mean, I think some of his answers for why we don't do better are off base, but I think that, you know, he's spot on other things. And again,
well, and he's not afraid in those books either to say, oh, and here's the bad part, you know, the, oh, we're going to castrate this guy because he struck someone one time, you know, right?
Right.
And so we got to weed that, you know, eugenics kind of out of the population. We can't let him reproduce.
Yeah, and he has, Sawyer does, other books on the Hugo list where, like, they are just brutally violent at times. And you know, that would be where I would say I kind of bounced off some of this stuff, because I think, I don't know why, but as I've gotten older, I've gotten more queasy about just in-your-face written violence or visual violence in media and stuff. And so that can sometimes make me bounce off.
I know that The Player of Games was another of your favorites off the non-winners list, right?
Yeah, but it wasn't nominated.
It wasn't. Okay. So that was one of we've been going back and forth on emails for months on this. And I think that was one of the, didn't even get a nomination, but I love it.
Yeah. Ian M. Banks would be, you know, like I said, Octavia Butler to me is the most egregious one that wasn't even nominated. Ian M. Banks has one nomination for Hugo for best novel, and it was for The Algebraist, which was the first book I read from him. And I believe I was in my early 20s then, and it absolutely enthralled me. It is a very, very good novel, and it's standalone. So readers who like standalone, go get The Algebraist. It's very good. But Ian M. Banks is like sort of just a huge miss on the Hugos. And from what I understand, I think we're talking about this in that Discord server, but apparently the reason that he didn't end up is because a lot of the novels were only published in the UK for years. And so they didn't make it across the pond, so to say, for years. And so they weren't eligible, or the eligibility rules hadn't changed yet. I'm not exactly sure how it works, but Player of Games is definitely, I know most people, when they talk about the culture novels from Ian Banks, say that Use of Weapons is often the favorite of everyone. But I love Player of Games, and in part because I think just he has paragraphs in that novel just for fluff, like background fluff for the story or world, where I'm like, I want to read a whole series about just that. Mm-hmm. Like, they're flying over the planet, and I forget which planet they're on, but they're flying over a planet, and there's like a prison below, and they talk about how the people are like incarcerated in the prison, and it's almost like this puzzle system and all these things. And I'm like, I want to read novels set in that prison and figure out, you know, can someone ever get out of there, or why are they there? But it's just a random paragraph that he just throws away because, you know, it's just fluff for his story. And to me, that's not because it's not because he's laissez-faire about developing his world. It's because he had so many robust and excellent ideas about how to write science fiction, and about how to have these alien cultures, and about how to have these totally different worlds, that they were just oozing out of every book you read from him, where it just feels so lived in and real. Yeah, Ian Banks is a big miss as far as never having won. And I hope all listeners, please make sure, you know, you put that, what is it called? The culture book here. I have it on my shelf. Ian M. Banks, The Culture of the Drawings, best related book. They published his basically sketches of culture novels and things. And I think that he, you know, posthumously deserves this win. So there's my plug for Ian M. Banks.
Yeah, especially for Glasgow Worldcon. So,
yes,
yeah, cool. Any other non-nominees that you wanted to highlight?
Oh, non-nominees. Oh, okay. So another book that I think got a nominee that could have, or maybe should have been the winner, would be Year of the Quiet Sun by Wilson Tucker. Time travel is a subgenre of science fiction that I love, sort of in principle, but I think this is my bias showing. I think it's rarely done right. Like, a lot of times I think that time travel is just used as an excuse either to go to the past without having to do a lot of research on the author's part. Like, well, we can just explain anything that goes wrong by saying, well, it was because time travelers messed it up or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's why there's a historical inaccuracy. Or they just use it as sort of like I just want to show these different parts of time and we're not really going to do much with it. So having novels where the time travel portion actually impacts either the real world today or has sort of like an impact on the past in ways that you can see today are my favorite types of time travel novels. And Year of the Quiet Sun sort of goes in between that a little bit, because they have invented a time travel device which allows them to sort of go backwards and forwards in time. But meanwhile, in the United States, there's sort of a despotic president on the rise who they're worried that if he wins is going to make it so that, you know, basically America turns into this horrible dystopic nightmare. And
what a wild fantasy.
Right. I know. Thankfully that, you know, couldn't possibly happen. And so they sort of like try to go forward in time and figure out like, well, did he win? And if so, how did he win? And what's going to happen? Meanwhile, though, there's tons of questions about race and in ways that I think are extremely surprising. And if I may, just for a second, put up huge spoiler warnings. Can I say one huge spoiler thing from this novel?
All right, okay. Go for it.
So Wilson Tucker, the thing that I think really makes this novel work is that he never tells you really what the main character looks like. He never says whether he's white or black or any race. And so me, at least, as a reader, I just assumed it's a white dude. Well, When he goes forward into the future, into this, what has turned into this awful racial wars, all these things, it turns out that the main character is black. And Tucker intentionally, I believe, made you as the reader assume whatever you assumed about that character so that he could reveal at the end your own internal biases about race and your own assumptions about how, you know, what a person who was black would have interacted with people in his own time. And I just thought that that was such a stunning reveal and such a smart way of looking at racial tension, because it puts you, the reader, into the shoes of the person who is either having those biases or having to deal with what you thought about race in a way that feels like it should have been impossible in a science fiction novel. And so Year of the Quiet Sun, I think, you know, it's sort of like the sleeper candidate to win that year, but I think it would have been a very worthy choice to win.
Nice.
Oh, and this is my another plug, and this shows my fandom, but you know, they only recently introduced best series into the Hugos, and which is honestly a category I love. I'm so glad it's there because A, as a voracious reader, it means, hey, you know, we have a 14 book series and it got best series. It's like, okay, great. I have an excuse to read, you know, 14 books if I end up liking that series. But, you know, Wheel of Time never won. It did get nominated as a whole series because they like changed the rules, I think, that year to allow it to get nominated as a whole series. But man, again, it's kind of like Lord of the Rings where it's a series that has been so impactful on so many readers. I mean, every one of those 14 novels was a number one New York Times bestseller and introduced so many people into fantasy. Like for me, Wheel of Time was my gateway into epic fantasy. Like I knew fantasy existed and, you know, I knew about Lord of the Rings. I'd seen the movies, but Wheel of Time were the books where I was like, oh, this is a thing that you can do, you know, for over a dozen novels. And I really wish that it had gotten some nominees because some of those books are just so fantastic. And Robert Jordan, the way he imagined this world of rich color and narrative and smells and sights, it's just beautiful. And I know some readers will bounce off it and that's fine. I mean, not everyone likes the same thing, but 800 page books, you know, 14 of them minimum. If you want to get into an epic fantasy series and you haven't, you got to give them a try. I just have to give that a plug because I also want the Amazon TV series to go on forever because I've been enjoying that as well.
That's one that I have not. I think I got the audiobook recently and listened to the first chapter, but I haven't gone any further. So,
oh man, you are in for a treat if you continue. And I mean, they just, like I said, they do sort of get to the point where you're like, okay, I get it. You want to describe the clothes of this city and you have a whole vision of what every single person might wear or what they might eat. And like, let's move on with the plot. But truly, it's such a richly imagined world where you can feel you just feel it. It feels like you just live there today.
Hmm. Nice. Yeah. I mean, epic fantasy has never been my favorite. So we'll see one of these days.
Yeah. I suspect you're more of a science fiction fan just in general.
Yeah. Yeah.
One thing that I was wondering just to spitball about the Hugo Awards, and something that always struck me as I was reading this list was that there has, to my knowledge, never been any tie-in novel even sniffing a nomination. So, and what I mean by that is like Doctor Who, Star Wars, Star Trek, you know, you name it. Mm-hmm. None of these sort of expanded universe type novels ever even got close. And I guess I just wanted to mention that now, because to me, you know, when you talk about misses in the Hugos, like the Hugos, to an extent, are, I think, intended to be about the like literary merits of science fiction and fantasy novels. Sure. I think that that is some of the intent. And so people tend to see tie-in novels as just inherently missing that. Like you can't write a tie-in and also have great literature, right? Like that can't happen. But I think, and I think that you would probably agree, I think that that is a mistake. And mm-hmm. I just wish that whether it was its own category, like a tie-in subcategory of Hugo's or something, I wish that that could be acknowledged somehow, because there are, I think, some truly wonderful tie-in novels out there. My own knowledge is mostly from Star Wars. So like whether you have the Thrawn trilogy from Timothy Zahn, which I think, I think those are more excellent space adventures if you like Star Wars, but there's the Darth Bane trilogy that talks about like this Sith Lord, where it really is just an excellent anti-hero, where you find yourself rooting for the bad guy and being like, oh no, that's bad, I shouldn't root for the Sith. But it's not just Star Wars-y Sith-y. It's like truly there are evil acts happening here where you can understand why this person wants to do this. And you actually sort of are like, yeah, that doesn't seem like the worst idea in this moment. And to me, that does, again, just going back to it, that encompasses part of what makes great science fiction, is making you think about yourself or making you think about humanity. And having that happen in Star Wars novels was like really surprising. And so I would just like to see, I guess, some acknowledgement that those sort of fans exist. And I mean, have you ever been to a Worldcon?
No. So, nope, this year will be my first one.
Only one that I was at was, you know, ShyCon 8, which was a lot of fun. I had an absolute blast, and I'm hoping to go to Seattle next year. But, you know, those cons, to my knowledge, at least Worldcon isn't, there's not a lot of people dressing up in Star Trek or Star Wars characters or whatever. It's usually like you have your t-shirt, you know, it's about the books largely. I mean, obviously movie as a category. But I think like, in a sense, I almost feel like we're missing out. There's like this Hugo fandom, and then there's this tie-in fandom. And it's almost like, while there is tons of overlap between those two, it would be wonderful to see some sort of like hand-holding, almost, to see like, is there a way to like help heal some of the wounds from last year's Hugos, where we could say like, hey, how do we reach out to some of these huge fandoms where like, hey guys, like we have a category for Doctor Who and Star Wars and Star Trek and all ye fans, that's not just best TV, you know, episode or best series, but also like, what is the best tie-in fiction? I mean, and I'm a huge Warhammer 40K fan, so I'd be all about some of this, you know, in the grim dark future, there is only war. And, you know, which, yeah, it is sort of funny to think that there can be great science fiction there, but I really think that we're missing out by not having those in the conversations sometimes, because they just have really excellent fiction. And just because they're existing in an established universe, I don't think takes away a lot from them.
Right. I mean, it kind of gives the reader a leg up into the world, right? Because you don't have to, you know, you're not going to have to slog through the invention of something brand new, right? I mean, in Doctor Who or Star Trek, right, it's going to introduce the new planet or the new whatever is going on, but you already have that in with the main characters. And so it is sort of a gateway thing, right? You can get readers into science fiction through that. And so I do think there's an important role that tie-in fiction plays. And I think it's, the temptation would be to go, well, that's training wheels science fiction. And once I'm off that, then I'm not going back to it. And, you know, to be honest, I haven't really gone back to Star Trek novels were really mine. I mean, the Thrawn trilogy, I was reading them when they were coming out, right? And waiting for the next one to come out. And that was really annoying. Yep. But Star Trek, you know, I was into Star Trek The Next Generation, so I read a couple dozen of the TNG novels, and I haven't really gone back to that. I finally did a couple of years ago with David Agronoff to read Federation, which is an excellent tie-in novel. And it's the kind of novel where I read it and I'm like, wow, that, you know, that should win some kind of award. And maybe there is an award for tie-in novels. Let's find out if there is, and we can branch off a podcast for it.
Yeah, I think they have it at Dragon Con. I think they have several different versions at Dragon Con. It's just, I don't know why, I just haven't really gotten into the Dragon Con stuff yet. So maybe what I'm saying is I need to try to get over there sometimes, but I mean, just the fact that you're saying that, you know, with fine, you know, you read that book and you're like, man, this does deserve an award. It's like, I just think it would be great to have some acknowledgement of tie-in fiction at the Hugos. And I think it'd be an easy thing for, you know, whether the Seattle Worldcon or an upcoming one, to just say, we're just going to try this category out, you know, and it might end up just being, you know, Doctor Who fan people versus, you know, Warhammer fan, you know, and maybe it's just a disaster. Who knows? But you don't know until you try it. And
you know, that would make an interesting suggestion for a panel at WorldCon, right? So I have to think about that for next year, maybe.
Yeah. Best tie-in fiction.
Yeah. What's the role of tie-in fiction? And, you know, why aren't we acknowledging, you know, the good parts?
Yeah. And like you said, too, I mean, I think to an extent, some readers are almost put off by, like, when you see Wheel of Time, it's an easy example, 14 books, you know, the last one's over 1,000 pages. I think the last four are over 1,000 pages. That's a huge commitment. But if you pick up a Star Wars book, pretty much no matter where you are in Star Wars, like, you know, you're probably going to be able to understand that book. You don't have to go through 800 pages of exposition to even get your feet down in the world.
Yeah.
And I think there's something to be said for that, because some of the authors in tie-in fiction have realized that and utilized it. Adrian Tchaikovsky is a great example. He has now written some Warhammer 40K fiction where he has been able to play. And I'm sure any reader who has read him knows that he's excellent at big ideas, at, you know, sort of asking the big questions, having these huge dramatic worlds. And so with Warhammer 40K, he could just jump in, have these built-in assumptions about the world, and play with some of the dynamics of that in some extreme ways. So seeing some quote-unquote mainstream authors or really popular sort of power hitters of science fiction, fantasy authors playing with tie-in fiction, I think is also fun. And I just want to, I almost want to destigmatize that some, to say, like, that's okay. Like, we shouldn't fault someone for going and playing with Star Wars for a while or whatever, because some of that, you know, you could make it better. A.C. Crispin is another example. You know, she wrote the Han Solo trilogy for Star Wars. And she wrote a bunch of Star Trek fiction and I believe some other tie-in fiction too. And then she had her own series as well. But she wrote such phenomenal characters where, you know, like, you really got into the people's heads. And I think, I don't know, I don't like the stigma, I guess. And so, so, you know, we talked about, like, not hating on other people's likes. And a phrase I heard a long time ago, I don't remember who to credit it for, is just to not yuck other people's yums.
Yeah.
And because, like, the world's too harsh already. We don't need to, like, dunk on someone for liking whatever we don't like. Right. Like, and to an extent, I think that happens with tie-in fiction where it's like, oh, you spend your time reading that. And so, sorry, I'm going so far afield from Hugo's, but my tie back into that is I think that there should be some acknowledgement of the existence of tie-in fiction.
I like it. So your next project is finishing up all the nominees for the Nebula?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm going to probably do a big smattering. I've really been enjoying the British Science Fiction Award winners as well, and the Arthur C. Clarke, because, again, you have more abroad, I guess, authors popping up. You know, Arthur C. Clarke especially has some where there's very little overlap some years between that and the Hugos, and you're like, oh, these are just all different. There was one that won the award, I want to say 3 years ago or so, called The Animals in That Country. And it was just a super fascinating look at a pandemic world. Whoa, you know, watch out. Which I imagine was written pre-COVID, you know, and so it was published sort of at an unfortunate or maybe fortunate time. But also talked about, like, sort of the way that disinformation can play into people's fears and doubts and dreams and hopes. And so, yeah, basically, if it has an award, and maybe I should, like we just talked about, maybe I should throw the Dragon Con awards in there too. I'm going to try to go through it. So my quest is basically just all big awards, going to hit them all, you know, Locus, Nebula, Arthur C. Clarke, Philip K. Dick, Ursula Le Guin, you know, all of these awards that are coming out, and just trying to get as many of them as possible, because, I mean,
why not?
That's what I love to do.
Yeah, it's super fun. That's cool. All right. Well, I think we're probably about wrapped. Where can people find you?
So the website that I write most of my science fiction fantasy stuff on is eclectictheist.wordpress.com. So it's the word eclectic, the word theist, T-H-E-I-S-T, .wordpress.com. Again, I do have reviews of like basically every year of the Hugos coming. I'm through 1997, so we're going to get to the 2000s pretty soon and out of the hard science fiction slump. So if you don't like hard sci-fi, get ready. There's more coming. And if you do, time to start reading right now because the 90s are here and hard sci-fi is here to stay. And then I also write about random stuff. Like I've been reading all the presidential biographies and stuff. So there's all kinds of eclectic things to explore there. So
Your series on your read through of the Hugos is really excellent. And it gives me ideas of where to jump off. And that kind of gave me the idea to do this, this episode.
Thank you. I mean, I always have fun on your podcast, so I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm sure we'll talk again sometime down the line. JW, thanks for doing this.
Thank you.
All right.